Good afternoon, everyone. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Throughout the winter of 1864-1865, Union forces under General Ulysses Grant's army had constructed an elaborate network of trenches that ran from Petersburg to Richmond, laying siege to the Confederate capital of Richmond. Lee's Confederate army slowly dwindled due to the tightening grip on their food and supplies. Conversely, Grant's army swelled with well-fed and well-supplied reinforcements. On March 25th, Lee attacked part of the Union trenches at Fort Stedman in a desperate attempt to break the siege and split Grant's forces in two. When that attack failed, Grant began mobilizing his forces along the entire 40-mile front. Southwest of Petersburg, Grant sent General Philip Sheridan against Lee's right flank. Sheridan moved forward on March 31st, but the tough Confederates halted his advance. Sheridan then shifted his troops to cut the railroad that ran from the southwest into Petersburg, but the focus of the battle became Five Forks, a road intersection that provided the key to Lee's supply line. Lee instructed his commander there, General George Pickett, to hold Five Forks at all hazards. On April 1st, Sheridan's men slammed into Pickett's troops. Pickett had his force poorly positioned, and he was taking a long lunch with his staff when the attack occurred. General Warren's 5th Corps supported Sheridan, and the 27,000 Yankee troops soon crushed Pickett's command of 10,000. The Union lost 1,000 casualties, but nearly 5,000 of Pickett's men were killed, wounded, or captured. The vital intersection was now in the Union's hands, and Lee's supply lines were completely cut off. Grant ordered a follow-up attack all along the Petersburg-Richmond front, and Lee was forced to evacuate the cities. Both armies then began a race to the west, but Lee could not outrun Grant. 8 days later, on April 8, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered, effectively ending the United States Civil War. I shared that particular piece of military history because it is so pertinent to today's chat. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines need the same basic necessities that all of us need to survive: food, shelter, medicine, but then add to that ammunition, fuels, and parts to repair weapons and vehicles. Now, whether Napoleon or Frederick the Great deserves credit for first stating an army marches on his stomach, we do know that Napoleon lost more soldiers to spoiled food than he did in battle. In fact, it was such a challenge that he offered a reward of 12,000 francs to anyone who could come up with a reliable method of preserving food. This is the precursor to the modern food canning methods we know today. Alexander the Great's 35,000-man army traveled with no more than a 10-day supply of food. Supply chain logistics were always a critical part of his battle planning, even then. And in fact, the day after George Washington assumed command of the Continental Army, he created the position of Quartermaster General the very next day to keep his troops provisioned. The best-trained troops become ineffective if they lack food and water. The most advanced rifle becomes nothing more than a club without ammunition. Today, American Warrior is pleased to welcome today's guest, Rear Admiral Thomas Tron, United States Navy retired. Admiral Tron earned his commission through the University of Washington's Naval ROTC program. Some of his sea duty assignments included supply officer on the USS Lewis and Clark, which was a ballistic missile submarine, supply officer on the U.S. Tarawa, sorry about that, Admiral Tron, where he led logistics during Operation Determined Response, which were the recovery efforts for the USS Cole. He was also Chief of Staff for Logistics for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, Vice Director for Logistics to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and was heavily involved in United Response, which were the relief efforts in Haiti. He commanded the U.S. Central Command Deployment Distribution Operations Centers in Kuwait, and was also Commander of the Defense Logistics Agency, DOD's largest command logistics support agency. He currently serves as the Chief Integration Officer for Crestwood Technology Group. Admiral Tron, welcome to American Warrior. Suffice to say, you're an expert at getting boots and bullets where they need to go.
Well, good afternoon, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm humbled and privileged to be on the show with you, so thank you very much.
Well, you are an expert, Admiral, and I tell you, I've been wanting to cover this subject for so long because very often those of us, the civilians, we see the pilots, we see the Navy SEALs, we see the folks that are, you know, kind of get the headlines. But as I mentioned before, none of that works without bullets and boots and foods and fuel. Is that an accurate assessment?
That is. It's interesting. Before I came on the show, I Googled logistics quotations and came up with about 30 pages. So I think logistics is probably the most quoted issue in the military and probably the least practiced. So I think your assessment is pretty notable. Everybody from Alexander, Sun Tzu, Napoleon, and everything forward, if you were a general or an admiral, you probably have a quotation that puts logistics ahead of the line. So I think you're spot on.
Well, Admiral, we're going to share some more examples of that, both historically as well as more current-day practices, because like I said, it's very rarely that we get an expert like yourself on. But let's back up a little bit. You were an ROTC graduate. Why the Navy, and how did you get into logistics?
Well, first of all, my father escaped Norway during a prisoner exchange, came to the United States, joined the Navy as an E-1, ultimately became a E-9, a Master Chief Petty Officer in the Navy, a Warrant Officer, and then an LDO, a Limited Duty Officer, all with a sixth grade education. So I decided to follow in his footsteps. My brother and my sister and my mom all served in the United States Navy. Totaling about 110 years we provided to the Navy. And it was the first time when I retired in 2013 that there was not some member of my family on active duty since 1944. So it was a family tradition, and I'm very happy and pleased that I did it.
So a century of service from the Tron family.
Yes, sir.
Wonderful. Now, how did you, when you went through ROTC, I understand most cases you get to choose the kind of duty most times. What led you to supply chain management?
Well, it's interesting. I rode crew while I was at the University of Washington and went down and took a test to be a U.S. Navy SEAL and completed successfully the test. And at the end, they told me I'd have to get my a waiver for my eyesight. And I asked them, what would happen if I didn't get the waiver? And they said, well, you could just go drive ships. And I said, you know, there's got to be something better than that for me. And so I chose the logistics field, which was certainly in my family, that 110 years, except for my sister, who was an NCIS agent, was all spent in the logistics world. And so it was just the right fit for me.
Perfect. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that history. You know, particularly given now that I know about your family, it'll be interesting to get your perspective on how things have changed over the years as far as getting those boots and bullets to the right place there. We'll talk a little bit of history. Folks, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined today by Rear Admiral retired Thomas Tron, United States Navy. We're talking about logistics, the tail to the tooth. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, here in American Warrior. We're joined by Rear Admiral Thomas Tron, United States Navy retired. Admiral Tron has been involved in getting bullets and butter and boots and fuel and ammunition to the troops pretty much his entire career, and in fact his whole family's done it over a century. So again, Admiral, I'm excited to hear that. I didn't realize we had such a vast, I mean, you're a resource, but wow, the whole family.
Yeah, my dad's the real hero of the family, as you can imagine. Probably at 12 years old, leaving a home and coming on a train surrounded by SS folks into Berlin. He was held in Berlin at the rail yard until the exchange took place, and then left to go on to Portugal, and then Portugal back to the States. So he's the hero of the family.
Now, sir, your name is not spelled the way it sounds. What is the origin of that? Is it Norwegian or?
Yes, it's Norwegian.
Okay. All right. Now, Admiral, we talked a little bit about some examples, just so the civilians out there can understand get a little better idea of what we're looking at. A couple weeks ago, I had Dale Dion, who's a historical consultant, a military consultant to the film. So I don't know if this is completely accurate, but in the film, The Battle of the Bulge, they talked about the German troops carrying hoses with them to siphon fuel. And I think historically it's accurate to say part of the reason, not the entire reason, but part of the reason that initiative failed was because of lack of fuel. Explain to our listeners the tooth-to-tail concept, if you will. What does that mean from a military standpoint?
Well, the tooth is typically the pointy end of the spear and really is the war-fighting piece. The tail is really the logistics piece, and depending on how you define logistics, it's made up of transportation, supply chain, medical, fuel, ammo. In there is tech manuals, training manuals, and everything that the soldier, sailor, or airman or Marine needs to do their job.
Okay, and our, go ahead.
No, it's just, it's that line from the logistics end all the way out front to the fighting line, and how you get that material to those who need it.
And generally, sir, is it Reader's Digest version, there's much more tail than there is tooth, or there should be?
Typically, there is. I'm not saying that that's the right ratio, but unfortunately, that's typically what it takes to maintain a fighting force forward.
Now, Admiral, being a Navy man, I'm just kind of curious. There are certain, you know, moving things when you have railroads or roads is one thing, but moving across huge oceans is a little bit different. Are there any challenges, given your experience, that is unique to the Navy? And I tell you, I love the fact that you did serve on a submarine. We've got our very own USS Tucson. And I try and emphasize, you know, if you're out there someplace you're not supposed to be, you can't just pop up and, you know, take delivery of some fresh, you know, fresh coffee and gather the mail.
Well, I would tell you that submarine logistics in itself is maybe the most difficult in that you don't have that way, that opportunity to replenish underway. And so if you don't have it when you take it, you learn to live without it, and hopefully you didn't forget anything that you really needed during a deployment. From a surface or an aircraft carrier standpoint, in terms of replenishing a moving force, I think it's obviously one of the most difficult things that there is to do. It's very well orchestrated, and I would submit, because we've been doing it for so long, which makes the Navy what it is today, more so than any other Navy in the world, the ability to replenish underway is key to our Navy's success. Obviously, a little more difficult to hit a moving target during a deployment than it is a stationary force, but because we've rehearsed that so many times, it really allows us to get to the fight with as little bit of consternation as possible, as opposed to moving forces into an Iraq or an Afghanistan, which require different lines and different schemes of maneuver to make that possible.
Do you, given the speed with which some of the most recent battles have taken place, does that create special challenges, or is that just something you work into the formula and plan for?
If you kind of know what you're getting into, you can plan it. I think the secret to logistics is its flexibility. Certainly, you're always aligned with your combatant commander, or your battlefield commander. His requirement changes or her requirement changes every day, every minute, every second. And so logistics, by definition, has to be flexible and has to be able to respond to the requirement that they get at any minute, any hour, any day, any week. So it really is the logistician that's the most flexible and the most creative thinker, quite frankly, that will win the day at the end.
So maybe kind of the old Radar O'Reilly concept?
Well, hopefully we're not using forms in triplicate anymore, but certainly I think the ability to think on your feet and the ability to create solutions that facilitate the warfighter is obviously what you want to do when you're in the fight.
Now, Admiral, I'd like to have you walk us through, I know there's probably no traditional formula, but later in the show I want to have you kind of walk us through that, and I want to come back to that question because I've often wondered, you know, I'm sure logistics has plans in place, but to what extent the on the battlefield commander says, okay, here's what I'm going to do, and these are some special things I need. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about the Defense Logistics Agency. I mean, this is a huge, huge organization. I wasn't even that familiar with it until you agreed to come on the show. More than 2,430 weapon systems, 9 supply chains, 5.3 million different items, operating in 48 states, 28 countries, and not just the supply side of things, but also the acquisition side.
Correct. It is probably singularly the largest logistics headquarters that we have. What DLA was born out of was the wholesale ability to supply the services, which is rapidly changing. And so the Defense Logistics Agency is trying to move from being a wholesale provider down to operating in the retail environment alongside our maintenance folks, our depots, our repair depots, and as you said, everything from clothing to fuel down to piece parts and items. A funny story, when I was down in Red River, Texas, I saw Humvees and almost till the end of the earth, quite frankly, and I was kind of laughing because I said, there must be a Humvee here for every soldier in the Navy. And one of my assistants sat next to me said, I'd quit laughing if I were you, sir, because you own all of those right now. And so it became not very funny very quickly. So.
Oh, sure. And you own the maintenance costs of every single one of those, too.
Well, not the maintenance costs. I hold it until the maintenance center calls for it, inducts it, so to speak. But certainly I own the biggest crane in the world down in Anniston, Alabama, and the reason why that's the biggest crane, because they do track vehicles, so M1 tanks are brought in. And as you can imagine, an M1 tank is pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the Humvees, I looked up and I said, who owns that crane? And the guy looks at me and says, you do. And so I own it all the way up to the maintenance until the induction. And then when it comes off the production line, I owe it again until it goes to the end-use customer.
And, Admiral, just to emphasize again for civilians out there, what I had read somewhere that it was on the Internet, so it must be true. Your average battle tank gets about, what, 0.4 miles to the gallon, thereabouts?
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, you don't drive Humvees. You drive H2s or H3s, but they're not very fuel efficient, obviously.
Right. So backing that vehicle up is not just the food for the crew and the rounds for the gun, but also the fuel to keep it running, because otherwise it's just a big old paperweight.
Yeah. If you look at it, fuel obviously becomes the number one factor, because the force doesn't move without fuel. And, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, if you were going to have something blow up, it was going to be a fuel tanker, because obviously it gave the image of not only noise, but sight. And so nobody wanted to blow up a 50-foot trailer full of clothes. They just would rather have the fuel blow up. And then certainly the ammunition. You need to get the ammunition to the fight. Otherwise, it goes to swords and doesn't go very well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, all the other things in terms of the quality of life, in terms of food and everything else that goes along with it. But fuel and bullets are going to be the two most important things to get out there first.
Well, and that also harkens back historically, at, you know, during the Civil War, when General Grant ordered General Sheridan to basically go through the Shenandoah Valley. As I understand, his quote was, leave the valley so barren that a crow flying over would have to pack its own lunch. That only not only disrupts supply and the enemy's ability to fight, but it probably also has a huge morale impact.
Absolutely. And you know, think of a highly conditioned athlete and their dietary requirements. And I would tell you that in the military, we have war-fighting athletes, and they need to get their food so they can go out every day and do their jobs.
Now, sir, the deal, the Defense Logistics Agency, is not just supporting the military. You also support other federal agencies and even some of our partner nations?
Sure. It's called the whole of government, and typically where we are, they are, and so it makes great sense, and a lot of synergy goes between those whole of government activities, as well as the foreign military sales environment. Absolutely.
Okay, when we come back, sir, I'd like to talk about sort of the civilian ramifications of supply and logistics. Our United States military, and particularly the Navy, also is very involved in supporting when it comes to humanitarian relief. But just one quick comment, though. In your supply chain, it's not just the military. It's also the Rosie the Riveter types. I think you worked on the Tomahawk project once upon a time. We had the crew from the USS Tucson out there to visit the Tomahawk line, because that's the principal offensive weapon they use. And I tell you what, there was such a sense of pride when those people working on the assembly line got to meet the end users of their product. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful moment. Is that so? Just pretty much, it's not just military, it's civilians as well, and they're a very important cog in the machine?
It starts at the beginning and ends at the end, and I know that's a Yogi Bearism, but I would tell you that the face of the warfighter is changing. It's Rosie the Riveter. It's the contractors in the battle space. It's the folks who wear the uniforms, and it's the great DOD civilian workforce that keeps things moving at all times. And so those folks that are not in uniform don't get near the credit that they're due every day, because what they do is extremely important.
Wonderful. Hey, folks, it's your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. I'm joined by Rear Admiral Thomas Tromm. We're talking logistics and supply chain from the tail to the tip of the spear. Hey, listen, if you can check us out, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can download all the past shows, get some show notes. Give us a visit sometime when you get a second. Again, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Give us a call. We're live, 751-1041. We'll be right back after these messages.
Expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, here on American Warrior. We're talking about logistic and supply chain. You know, very often we don't think about what it takes to support a modern military or even what it took to support Alexander the Great's troops, but involves lots of things that don't necessarily have to do with rifles. And Admiral Tron, our guest is Rear Admiral Thomas Tron, United States Navy retired, was at the top of the chain, if you will, top of the supply chain. Does that work, Admiral?
Well, I'm not sure I was at the top, but I was somewhat close. How's that?
Yeah. Well, you're close enough to see it from where you were. let's talk a little bit, Admiral, real quick about, you know, very often when it comes, not just war fighting, but when it comes to relief efforts, the United States military assets are often very key to that, in particular the United States Navy. You know, all kinds of examples, the USS Carl Vinson in Haiti in January 2010, December 2004, the USS Abraham Lincoln deployed off the coast of Indonesia. And you're not only providing supplies, but you're also providing expertise and the equipment to help save lives.
That's certainly true. And I was at the Pacific Fleet Command when the tsunami hit in 2004, and that's where that creativity comes in. And so it's, you know, one of the things that we learned was, you know, people were worried about malaria and things spreading, but quite frankly, a lot of salt water involved in the tsunami, so quite frankly, the mosquito infestation wasn't such a big issue down there. But things like... And I don't not mean to sound morbid, but getting the right body bag to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
In some cultures, black ones are okay. In other cultures, they demand white body bags. And certainly the civilian sector in terms of being able to provide the goodwill and aid that comes from the hearts and minds of the American people, getting that supply out to the affected region is critical as well. But when you stop and think about what it is you need, is not only do people need water, but they need something that they can refill with. And so we moved to 5-gallon jugs. We moved to 5-gallon collapsible jugs. We moved to 5-gallon collapsible jugs with water in them. And so the supply officer on the Lincoln was very creative in terms of thinking through those solutions and being able to give the affected population things that they could not only use immediately but reuse in the future as they move through the casualty.
So, Admiral, you were also involved with Haiti, correct?
Yes, I was.
And were there any unique problems there versus what you saw in the Pacific, or?
Well, the one thing that in a humanitarian disaster, there are things that are different, and you are dealing with lots of other activities that are trying to help. For example, USAID, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, and quite frankly, they're built much better to respond to those types of instances because they do it all the time. And so shelter units that USAID provide is really a material or a fabric that is given to people in the affected area so they can kind of build the shelters that they need and they want. Counterintuitive to the way we think, hey, let's give the people tents USAID and other care providers don't want those tents to become permanent structures. They want to be able to get the host nation back up on its feet and living the cultural lives that they're used to living, not in tents that were provided by us.
There you go, folks. You always learn something new on American Warrior, for example. I didn't realize we had to have two different colors of body bags. If you have a question for an expert, give us a call, 751-1041, with your question for Admiral Tron. Now, Admiral, I know there is no typical scenario, but can you kind of walk us through whether it be a military deployment or let's focus on the military deployment. What is the equipment? Are there pre-positioned assets? Is there a boat sitting somewhere in a port that's already stocked up with pretty much all the stuff you need to go? You mentioned water. To some extent, you might be moving water in. To some extent, you might be moving any equipment to produce water.
Right. But, most of the times when the Navy moves on a deployment, they're taking what they need with them. Certainly, nobody foresaw the USS Cole get blown up. And one of the main functions that we provided on the Tarawa have been, and please don't apologize to me, Tarawa is very much sacred ground for the U.S. Marine Corps. We were able to hold a ceremony at Tarawa for the Marines. It's Red Beach One. That's where the battle in the Pacific started for the Marines, and that's hallowed ground for them. And I was privileged to be able to see them ceremoniously pay tribute to the Marines that lost their lives down in Tarawa, obviously a great first step towards winning the Pacific back for the Marine Corps. But quite frankly, feeding the crew of the Cole who had broken into their ship store and had eaten just about everything they could out of the ship store, not because the Gulf of Aden Hotel was trying to provide food to them, but the crew just did not believe that given what had just happened to them, that somebody wouldn't try to poison them as well.
Sure.
And so, fortunately, we had field messing kitchens because it was an expeditionary Marine force that went with us. The coal was moored at a fuel pier, if everybody remembers. And so things like field kitchens were great on the beach, but we still need to figure out how to get the food from the beach out to the ship. And so, you run into those scenarios that you didn't really think you were going to do on a normal deployment. The amphibious group commander came by and told me, congratulated me on how well we were doing, and he was really glad that we were trained to be able to respond to that. My response to him was, we're making this stuff up every day as we go along. and that's what you have to do when you get in those situations, is do the best you can with what you got and figuring out winning solutions to complex problems. And our logisticians in any service have the capacity and capability to do that.
Now, Admiral, you didn't necessarily have to share that. I mean, you just, my confidence level. Well, no, you responded well. Okay, just doing it as you go works as long as it works.
Well, you know what? You make it work. And I would tell you that we call them normal deployments, but quite frankly, every service thinks they're getting into a normal deployment, but finds something different. And I would tell you that from the coal to the tsunami to the Haiti relief efforts, nobody trains you for that kind of stuff. And so you take your education, you take what you have, you combine it. And like I said, you create winning solutions to help the fight you're in. And it's all calculated. It's not, as easy as we all like to assume. But there's people out there that do that every day.
Now, sir, that brings me back to one of the questions we sort of touched on earlier in the program. So I've decided to invade Kuwait to kick out Saddam Hussein. I'm assuming there's a formula that says, okay, a soldier needs X number of bullets, Y number of MREs for this number of days in the engagement. But at what point do the commanders then come back to you or your personnel and say, hey, here's what I really need?
Well, there's only one thing true about a plan, And the plan is only as good as until you engage an enemy, and then the plan goes out the window.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, I think it is that sense and respond that the battlefield commander is going through. I would tell you that certainly they can use all the intelligence in the world, and somebody moves, somebody throws their cell phone away, gets a new number.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anybody reads General McChrystal's book, Team of Teams, the issue of adaptability becomes paramount in any situation.
Okay. Folks, again, we've got a great expert here, 751-1041. We're talking about logistics and getting assets where they need to be, not just for the military, but for civilian and in cases of crisis as well. And, I mean, Admiral, I'm learning a lot. This is, boy, what a huge challenge. And it's not just in times of war. I mean, just to operate. You know, soldiers or airmen or sailors or Marines, when they're training, they need clean socks. You know, they need ammunition for their rifles. So when we come back, Admiral, I'd like to talk a little bit how this translates to the private sector of the business world. You made some very good comments that folks who, particularly the civilians out there, need to know more about. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. Hey, check us out on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail, on Twitter, at Warrior Radio TUC. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the
world. Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about tooth to tail. That is the tail and the teeth of the military and what it takes for us to be successful, not only in a combat engagement, but just to maintain a well-equipped and efficient military, and a successful, a winning military. Our guest is Rear Admiral Thomas Tran. We're talking logistics and supply chain management. Now, Admiral Tran, a little bit, you know, some of the things in my world, in the business world, some of the items you touched upon when you're talking about military deployments certainly have got a very real application in the private sector. Many of us go to the grocery store. We don't give a second thought about where the tomatoes are coming from, how they got there, what needs to be done between, you know, the field and the refrigerated section of our grocery store. To a great extent, is there a lot of potential in the logistics career field in the private sector as well?
Yeah, and Ben, if you don't mind, I'll give a shout out to a group that I'm going to come down and talk to on the 27th of this month, the APEX organization. I think the talk or the evening starts at 6:30, but one of the things that I am going to talk about during the evening is the balance of military logistics and quite frankly, the industrial logistics. And I would tell you that you have to go back to the mediums of the two to understand the similarities and the differences.
Well, I tell you, Admiral, let me interrupt you. Rear Admiral is what, one star, two stars?
Just a one star.
Okay, so I'm still in deep trouble for interrupting you, but I want to do that because I think we've got someone, a gentleman who's involved with that, Kyle. Kyle is calling in. Kyle, did you want to talk about that event here in Tucson?
Sure, I'd just like to introduce that. Hi, Admiral Tran, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Great. Yes, Admiral Tran, I'm the VP of Programs for the Tucson chapter of APEX, and Admiral Tran has graciously accepted the invitation to come speak with us on April 27th, and that will be at the Lodge on the Desert, and he's going to talk about the what he'll tell you about is the defense and commercial planning sides, the different changes he has noticed for his career. So people, if they were interested in that, there is some registration fees, and they can check those out. It's at the apextucson.org website. Look on the events page. And this was kind of set up to try to involve as many military community as possible to just show that we're supporting them. I'm sure that we'll be giving a couple awards out to the local logistics readiness squadrons that we've seen in action recently. So we're just real excited. We hope to get some participation from the military community. We're reaching out to get contacts in public affairs and the Logistics Officers Association. So I'm real excited. I did serve with Admiral Tran back in 1987-88 on the submarine tender USS Simon Lake. AS-33, which was, I think, recently and finally decommissioned and drawn down. But that was an exciting time, and it kind of goes into what APEX is all about, and that not only was it a supply chain, but it was also a floating machine shop doing repairs for submarines, because not only did you have to resupply the submarines, but you also had to refit them and repair them. So that was a floating machine shop and all kinds of tasks that go along with that. And that's pretty much what APEX is supplying, manufacturing, and maintenance type jobs. So
great.
We're really excited to have you, Admiral Tron, and we're looking forward to April 27th.
Great. Thank you so much, Kyle. And Kyle was actually responsible for putting us together, Admiral. So now, but coming back to his point, particularly where we are here in Tucson on the southwestern border, a huge amount of product moving back and forth across the border from Mexico and parts further south. Rail, you know, it's probably easier to bring something into Mexico, bring it up to Tucson, and then further east than it is to bring it into Long Beach. As I understand it, sir, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the logistics career field is projected to be one of the fastest growing in the country.
Well, I would say anybody who's getting out of the military who served in a logistics sector, it probably has a bright future ahead of them. As I was saying, Ben, I think the difference on the military side, we use a readiness as a medium. On the commercial side, you use revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell you at the end of the day, those are about the same. Certainly, the planning horizon for creating readiness is a little bit further out in front of you as opposed to producing revenue. My experience is that people in ownership or CEOs want to know about their revenue today, tomorrow, next week. And really, in the military, you're really worried about future readiness and the ability to provide that. I think there's a couple key components in that. It's leadership versus management. It's learning versus education. It's data versus intuition. And in the civilian side, it's about organization. And on the military side, it's about command and control. But no matter what side you're on, whether you're in a military environment or commercial environment, I would tell you my 3 years outside of the Navy, when we talk about operational logistics in the Navy or in the joint service, that's no different than what companies are thinking from an operational logistics standpoint in terms of them driving revenue.
Sure, sure. And, sir, I'd like to talk a little bit about here right at the end is the importance and the value of hiring veterans. Before we do that, though, we've got a caller, Mark. Mark, you have a question or comment for Admiral Tron.
Yes. Hello. The question, let's say you have a small team, it's more of a small team logistics rather than major ships, but if you have a small team going into enemy territory and it's going to be out of supply for a period of time, say a week or 10 days, what is the typical amount of contingency supplies that they take with them, or do they try to take a minimum amount of contingency supplies, or is it really going to depend on the mission, or...
It hits on all of those things that you brought up. The ability to sustain whatever size of force, whatever mission you're in, requires a certain amount of self-sustaining. And that self-sustainment has to go with whatever that squad, platoon, or company is moving into. And then the replenishment becomes a little more pointed in terms of how long are those forces going to be there and how much footprint do you want to put on the ground. And so as odd as it may seem, in cases like Afghanistan, we were moving supplies on donkeys.
Oh, wow. Now, Admiral, did that donkey become your asset?
No, I think he was the name of a song. He became Tingaleo.
Great. Mark, thanks so much for your call, and thanks for listening to American Warrior Radio. Admiral, two things really quick. We've got about 4 minutes before the end of the show. Based on, particularly given your family's history, how do you see the changes? I mean, we've gone from, I was going to say from moving stuff on horseback, but I guess we're still moving on donkeys. But, now you've got C-130 drops. You've got air refueling tankers. What do you see down the line there? Will we be using remotely piloted vehicles to drop supplies into SEAL teams?
Yep, I think we will. I think when you think about that, when you're creating a logistics infrastructure, let's say out in the Pacific, and each one of your logistics hubs are within striking range of an enemy, how do you make that supply base mobile? Can you put it afloat, let's say, on a decommissioned LDEC or like the Tarawa, or a carrier where now you can move your logistics base at will? And what I call that is logistics maneuver. I don't think actually a friend of mine gave me that term, but that ability to move your logistics at will, not only from the perspective of delivering logistics on from a drone or from a floating base that can be moved at will, not only in terms of being able to get close enough to provide resupply, but also in terms of the new maneuverability to keep it out of the way of strike.
Okay. And, sir, your company got a great asset when they hired you. I'm a volunteer with the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. What last sort of thoughts in about a minute would you like to add about the importance of hiring veterans and the value that they bring to a private sector company?
I think it doesn't matter what position you have open in your company. Any veteran is capable of coming in and learning and providing that. And I think what you get inherently with hiring a vet is you get loyalty, you get dedication, you get ability, and you get desire. And I think when you have those four attributes in one person, I think it makes a no-brainer to hire them. At CTG, we've just brought in our first two wounded warriors. One was a combat medic and one was a member of the 4th ID in Kandahar. And I would tell you that their ability to absorb the work, digest it, and make it better as they regurgitate it is unfound in any normal person in the workforce. And so if you're in a position to hire out there, hire a vet, they will do you well.
Wonderful, sir, and thank you so much for your service to our country, and thanks for joining us here on American Warrior. We're looking forward to hearing more from you. Just a reminder, folks, if you'd like to check it out, it's Wednesday, April 27th at the Lodge on the Desert. Begins at 6:30 p.m. You can register going apics.tucson.org. You can meet the Admiral, speak with him in person. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in on American Warrior. Next week, we're bringing back another astronaut. He was the commander of Gemini 4 and Apollo 9. Jim McDivitt will be here with us on American Warrior. This show and other shows can be found and downloaded in the convenience of your home, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Check it out, Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail, or follow us on Twitter, Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, again, this has been your host. Thanks to Admiral Tron. All policies and procedures are to remain in place. See you next week.